Herzlich willkommen zum Dogged Right Podcast, dein Podcast für entspannte Hundebegegnungen. Wir wollen, dass stressige Hundebegegnungen ab jetzt für euch Geschichte sind, denn wir sind davon überzeugt, dass entspannte Spaziergänge die Voraussetzung für ein glückliches und gesundes Leben mit deinem Hund sind. Ich bin Tine, Trainerin für Menschen mit Hund, und in der heutigen Folge erfährst du, wie du deinem Hund Strategien vermitteln kannst, mit denen er selbst in Hundebegegnungen dafür sorgen kann, dass es ihm besser geht. Mit der Methode, die du heute kennenlernst, wirst du deinen Hund besser verstehen lernen und erschaffst Lernerlebnisse für euch beide, die zukünftige Hundebegegnungen wesentlich stressfreier werden lassen. Da die heutige Expertin aus den USA kommt, findet das Interview auf Englisch statt, aber keine Sorge, du findest die Übersetzung bei YouTube und kannst so bequem parallel mitlesen. Today's guest is a dog trainer, author, and international speaker based in Oregon, USA. I was lucky enough to be able to participate in one of her BAT seminars in 2019 in Berlin, and I still continue to learn from her about how to address all kinds of challenges in the everyday life with dogs. She specializes in dog reactivity and helps dog trainers and dog owners to rehabilitate and train dogs. She has a weak spot for fearful and reactive dogs, and therefore she has developed the BAT training method. It's behavior adjustment training, and it's especially for fearful and reactive dogs. So welcome to the Dog It Right podcast, Grisha Stewart.
Thank you, Tina. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I want to dive right into the topic, and I remember in the seminar that you gave in Berlin, you showed videos of your own dogs too. So what I want to know is, how has BAT changed your personal dog's behavior in dog greetings?
So BAT was, like you said, was originally developed actually for my own dogs. I was a dog trainer and working with reactivity with lots of other people, but my own dog, Peanut, was a dog who had reactivity to people, to other dogs, definitely people of all ages and sizes. And I can't imagine life without BAT, to be honest, and I'm really grateful that I learned that from my work with Peanut. I wish that I had it when he was a puppy. But I had that for my next dog. And so in his case with Peanut, he went from being able to, or not able to, you know, greet another dog or a person, to being able to, you know, walk right past other dogs, to have dogs sniff him, to go say hi to people. He was actually a therapy dog at a senior center. And it made all of the difference in the world for him. And then also then bringing another dog into my home, that's when it really shone for me, because then I was able to rehabilitate the reactivity that Bean had, my next dog, when he came to me at about 6 months old, and then also to integrate the two dogs together. So it's made a huge difference for my world. And I had tried all kinds of different positive dog training methods first, because those were already in my toolbox. And so this was another layer. Something that would work even if the dogs weren't in working mode, because what I found is that the other things worked as long as I was really paying attention and helping the dogs and coaching them through. But it was when it was really left to their own devices that they struggled.
Yeah, that sounds like an amazing change that happened there. And I know that a lot of listeners have different challenges with their dogs and how they react as soon as they see other dogs. So can you describe how your dogs were before you trained them, or especially Peanut, what kind of behavior he would show if there was another dog in sight?
Sure. It was actually really embarrassing as a dog trainer. So if I was focused on him, there was no problem. But if he wasn't kind of in a heel or, you know, focusing on me, then what would happen is that probably 100 feet, 35 meters away, he would alarm bark. So he would look at them and then have the sort of like, ow, ow, sort of bark at them. And that's not even the right sound. More an alert. That's more of a lonely bark. But anyway, there's a bark. And he was kind of bounce. And then if they got to him, he would, and tried to sniff him, he was already barking by then, but then he would start growling. And especially like young Labradors, he hated them or was terrified of them. I'm not really sure of his exact emotion, but he would kind of air snap at them. He fortunately was never, he had never injured a dog or anything like that. But I definitely work with lots of dogs who do have that kind of history.
Wow. Yeah, that's I know those exact behaviors from a lot of clients who come into our training, and it's quite embarrassing, as you said, because they say that they feel like they're not doing the right thing, they're not doing enough, and they're just not good enough as dog owners, and it's just really sad to see that they feel like they have failed. So I'm glad that there are things that we can do to help them, and I'm excited that you're sharing those things with us today. So. You said you tried other things before, positive training methods, and those kind of work for some situations. So which things did already work for you before you developed BAT?
So the things that worked were, for me, ended up being basically like management tools. So, for example, if I would see another dog out on the street, and unfortunately, a lot of times it ended up being one of my clients. And so instead of just avoiding me, they would like walk over with their dog specifically to say hi and show off their dog. And so I have my dog and I'm like, oh God, here it comes, you know. But after the training with him, then with the regular tools, so with click to calm basically, and what ended up turning into look at that. So using that kind of tool, because this was... probably 2003 or four, I want to say. So look at that had not come out as an official or control and leash hadn't come out as an official protocol, but basically that protocol, and it worked great. So as long as I was clicking when he would look at other people, we could have a conversation, or clicking for looking at the dogs as well. We could have a conversation as long as they kept their dogs away from him. And greeting was definitely still not something he was really capable of doing. But we could do kind of the canine good citizen type thing where he was sitting beside me and their dog was sitting over there, or at least not being allowed in his space. And then he was fine. So as long as I'm paying attention and treating, or I didn't even necessarily have to be giving a treat right that moment. As long as he knew that I was still in a training mode with him, he would be quiet. But the moment my attention really faded away from him and into the conversation, then he would bark.
That sounds quite exhausting, right? And it sounds yes. It sounds like also something that most of the people are trying to get away from. So when they approach us, usually one of their biggest goals is, I don't want to constantly be scanning the environment for the next possible challenge, and I don't want to have to be always aware of everything. So you were still in that mode, kind of where you always had to watch out for everything. And then how did that change? What was the next step for you?
So what changed for me next is I ran into a technique that it's called CAT, and it's a technique that now the practice that I did, it was not something I would do anymore. It was kind of a leaving the dog in a situation where he would bark and then waiting for him to stop as part of it, which is not something I recommend. But what I really took away from CAT is the idea of distance as a reinforcer, and that the barking isn't just like, we don't just say it's fear. We say, what is the function of this behavior? Why is he doing it? And how can we help him have behavior that still meets that need, but doesn't do it in such a way that it's, doesn't fit well with society. And so then I started doing sort of like CAT. I filmed it right away, and very quickly it morphed from what they would describe as CAT to what I later then called BAT 1.0. And then over there, after a while, that developed as well into now 2.0.
What does CAT stand for?
Constructional Aggression Treatment. And okay. Interestingly, that protocol has changed to look a lot more like BAT. So we're sort of like helping each other along in terms of progress.
So, that's awesome. Yeah. That's great. So the one thing that most people know about BAT, by the way, I asked our Instagram community what if they knew what BAT was, and it was exactly 50-50. So apparently half of them know and half of them don't, or at least the ones that participated. And the one thing that a lot of people know is that it looks super boring. And I remember you saying that at the seminar, if it looks boring, then it's right. And I feel like that's the exact same thing that I encounter in all of our trainings, that some people just think, well, but nothing happened just now. So what just nothing, my dog didn't even do anything. And then I'm like, yes, exactly.
Isn't that exactly what we're here for? Right, exactly. Do you want the dog that as you walk along, everybody notices how exciting your dog is? Or do you want the dog that, like, they just notice you happen to be with a dog, but there's not a lot going on? Yeah,
exactly. So other than BAT being boring, what do people need to know about it? Well, can you give us a brief little summary of what BAT is?
Sure. So BAT should not be boring for the dog. So the dog should be interested in exploring the space or whatever it is he's doing, or she. But it should be a chance for the dog to experience the other dog or the person or whatever you're getting them used to, in a way that's not too stressful. So they're exploring their environment, and oh, there happens to be a dog there at a distance that's totally comfortable. And then over time, we allow that dog to wander, our student dog to wander a little bit closer. But the human's job is really there as a kind of a stress management, like a parachute. So you're not allowing the dog to get too close. But otherwise, the dog is just wandering around the space. If someone were to look at a BAT setup, it would look like the dog's maybe looking for a place to pee or just exploring. It doesn't make very exciting TV. Although I'm teaching an online course right now, and it turns out it's not too bad in terms of in terms of that. So, just watching a setup, it should be pretty boring.
Yeah. What kind of online course is that? Is it possible to learn BAT from you online?
It is. So I have a couple of different courses. The one I was just speaking about is an advanced course, but I also have a course online that's a self-paced course that people can go through week by week with lessons. There's videos, there's text to read. And that's actually a really good course to go through with a trainer as well. So if you're a pet owner and you're not really used to training, but you have a trainer, then your trainer can go through that course with you. And so you can both learn it together.
That's great. That's awesome. And I think for some of the listeners right now, if BAT is new to them, they're not really sure where all of this is going. So within that course, do you start from the basics and from the goals that BAT has and how the basic things work?
Yes. Yeah. So that's the BAT 101 course. It's an intro course, so people can start not knowing about BAT at all. I do have a book, and for people who are much more visual, there's also a feature film series, like a DVD series, that is a good introduction to it as well, from anywhere from, you know, just starting at body language and working our way all the way through how to use the leash. Because in BAT, we use a 5-meter leash, so we allow the dog a lot of freedom, and that requires some specific handling skills. And that's a lot of what people do need to learn with BAT.
Yeah, I remember in the seminar, I was kind of surprised that we were spending quite a bit of time on the leash skills. And I thought, you know, I mean, it's leash skills, you know, that I'm going to hold a leash. But then after the seminar, I realized so many things that dog owners could do better, and it would just make it so much easier for them and their dog. So I think for everybody who's kind of thinking, well, it's a leash, I really recommend looking into leash skills, because it can change so much, because the leash is such a powerful tool that you should be aware of too, because sometimes just pulling a bit too hard. I think everybody knows the situation when the leash is pulling on your dog, you will realize that he's much more reactive, right? He'll be much more likely to bark. And if you're able to hold the leash in a way that doesn't happen as often, it's just so, so helpful. Yeah. So it's a topic that everybody should look into. So what I definitely want to do is I want to put a link in the show notes to that online course, but also definitely to the book, because I love that book. And I think it's just a great way to start also for everybody who wants to start with BAT.
Excellent. And one thing that came up for me while you were speaking is really thinking of the leash skills as like a dance. And I don't know if any of you out there have done partner dancing or like ballroom dancing, especially with someone who doesn't know what they're doing, right? So you kind of think of that like wedding that you've been to with the drunk guy that's like trying to lead you around the dance floor versus somebody who really knows what he's doing and guides you around. So with the leash skills, we're really not guiding. So that dance piece is a little bit off, but really knowing that interaction between the person and the dog, and not just the leash itself, but where we stand in relation to the dog, how we're breathing, all of that is really important. It makes a big difference in terms of reducing reactivity without the dog needing to have a huge amount of learning.
Yeah, I love that comparison. I've never heard that. And I do like salsa dancing, so there's definitely a huge parallel there. And also you said you're not guiding, but I know that you talk a lot about how people actually guide dogs and they don't know that they're doing it, so they're not aware of it. And as far as I understand, that's a big part of BAT, and that changed a lot of things for me too, how I look at dog greetings and the way that people sometimes guide their dog in a way that they don't even want to. They're changing the situation in a way that they don't want to. And also they don't know that there are so many ways to change the situation in a way that they do want to. And they can do that guiding the dog without actually having to pull on the leash. So maybe those might also be some little things that people can already start with, I think. So can you dive into that a little bit? What does the position of the dog owner to the dog have to do with dog greetings? Why does it even matter if my dog sees another dog where I'm standing?
So that's a great one for this. And essentially, if we think about your dog is always really aware of where you are and also aware of where the other bodies are if he's doing a greeting with another dog. So depending on your positioning, you could be leading him toward that. You could be supporting that. So if you're up ahead of his shoulders, you're usually the dog is going to follow you in that direction eventually. So you may be accidentally leading a dog to actually go say hello to another dog before he's ready. That's one thing. There's also, when you are greeting, paying attention to where you're standing relative to the dog so that you're not blocking the exit. Because what can happen is the dogs are in there sniffing, and then based on where we're standing, we're actually making it so that the greeting goes on longer. And you guys, if you have dogs, you know that usually it's when the greeting goes on too long that it goes badly. So making it so the dog can exit as soon as he or she wants to is important. And that's assuming that greeting is even possible at this stage, of course. That's something we would work up to in BAT very carefully, very slowly. And then eventually it'll become easy with lots of dogs, but we practice it with confederates, you know, with our helper dogs first. Anyway, so watching out for making sure we're not getting in the way of the exit. Also being aware of the leash, making sure that's not tangling. And so essentially kind of standing behind and a little bit to the side of the dog as there's a greeting and kind of circling around to make sure that goes safely.
Yeah, and not blocking the exit is one thing, but also maybe even showing the dog that there is an exit, because yes, it might not have learned that, because a lot of people kind of stand there and that seems to be kind of an instinct when two dogs greet each other that the owners kind of stand there. Sometimes they're super happy because, oh, they're greeting each other. But sometimes, you know, I know this from myself too. You're maybe because you're scared of what will happen or something, you kind of tense up and you're just
holding your breath.
Stand there. Yeah. Exactly. Holding your breath. Yeah.
Praying to whatever gods you believe in to have it not go badly. Yeah. And so if your dog is even at the point of doing greetings, having it be really, really short, even just to the point of like they go in as soon as they sniff each other, you click or you call the dog and you move away and give a treat. So that's one of the kind of management aspects of BAT. So there's a transition point between just wandering around and following the dog and letting them gradually work their way closer to when there's an actual greeting. So at some point, there's sort of like this magnetic power between the two dogs and they're drawn together. And so we have to sort of weaken that power, the attraction to each other, in order for them to be able to disengage soon enough before they start fighting. So pre-training a dog to respond to something like a clicker or a verbal recall, and then calling them away as soon as they go in for that greeting, move away, give a treat, and then you can decide, you know, maybe go like 5-10 meters away and then decide if they want to come back. So that way the dogs get this practice of greeting and leaving, rather than greeting, hoping it doesn't go badly, having it go badly, and then next time they're even more afraid or more aggressive.
Yeah, so you just mentioned that that's kind of the management part of BAT too, that you can already use that even if you don't know that much about BAT. You can use some of the BAT techniques, actually, like showing your dog that there's an exit, even if he's actually not quite ready for the greeting, but it just happens sometimes in your everyday life because it's hard to avoid maybe sometimes because the other dog just came around the corner. So there are some management aspects of it, but you just mentioned that you actually start at a very, very different point that is much further away from the other dog. So if I wanted to start BAT from scratch and I wanted to do it right, where would I start tomorrow? So for everybody listening, what's the first step for them?
Oh, so I think I would give you just enough information to be dangerous on a podcast. So
I would say,
so your starting point is, you know, read a book or watch the course or, you know, do something to really learn the technique. But in terms of what that would look like if I were to work with a client, for example, would be starting out, making sure the client has the leash skills, and then in a field or on a path or something far away from other dogs, following that dog. My very favorite type of a BAT setup, which is what we're talking about here, is where we have a helper dog and then our student dog is kind of following behind them. And that distance, we want it to be far enough that they're a little bit interested, but they're still totally interested in the environment also, or, you know, able to connect with you or whatever else. So they're following and then gradually kind of catching up. And anytime that you feel your own pulse go up, feel free to just call the dog away, move away, and then start over. Because if your pulse is going up, it's possible that the dog's is as well. Dog trainers tend to interrupt too soon. So if you're a professional dog trainer, you might want to just be patient. But if you're not, most regular pet folks seem to wait too long to interrupt. And so if you're getting a lot of barking and lunging, then err on the side of caution and just interrupt whenever you're feeling tense.
So maybe you could say try to keep it boring as much as possible for yourself.
Exactly.
And try to really watch out for your dog's body language, right? I feel like that's one of the biggest parts too. You were talking about leash skills, but I think also just learning about dogs' body language is so important as just like, yeah, one of the basic first steps to even be able to do BAT, because as you said, sometimes we just wait too long until it's already too late, and that's okay too. I think it's important to also stress that you shouldn't be stressing out about every time your dog barks. So it's, you know, it's gonna happen, and you have to focus on the positive things, which, yeah, reminds me of the dog journal that I gave you too when you were in Berlin, because we found at Dog It Right, we just found that it's so important to focus on the positive things, because you get so stressed out about little things. And that's good on the one side, because it shows that you're worried about your dog and you want to do everything right and you want to care for it and you want to help your dog and you want to be aware of all the challenges that you guys have every day. But it also pulls you down a bit, and it makes you focus on the negative things so much. So yeah, with our dog journal, for example, you just write down every day what you're grateful for. I know that you're a big fan of that too. I think that's one big thing that we have in common. And for anybody listening who really wants to focus on those things, those positive things that happen every day, it's just that we sometimes don't notice because we're so caught up in our everyday lives. But if you want to focus on those things and maybe you become a little more patient and then kind of find more of that positive energy, then I recommend you look into a daily gratitude practice. And if you want to use our dog journal, then you will find the link in the show notes and you can look into that. I highly recommend it. But coming back,
I like that book a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That makes me really happy. I was so excited to be able to give it to you because I knew that you were into gratitude also. And I think it's interesting because trainers who work like this and even dog owners, that come into our training, for example, at Dog It Right, they all already seem to have that mindset and it apparently comes kind of with positive dog training. And that's, I think that's so, so exciting that it goes hand in hand, that if you practice gratitude, you can focus on the positive things in training and you will automatically also be able to reinforce more of that positive behavior that your dog is showing. I just find that connection amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I definitely, you know, kind of going along with what you said in terms of the human side of things, I definitely find that humans get very stressed by their dogs having, you know, reactivity. And it's also the other way around, so that when we're stressed, the dog's picking that up. So anytime we can work on our own distress, that helps a lot. That's one reason why I have a class called How to Human, which is about, it has things like the gratitude practice, mindfulness, neuroscience, all the various ways that we can relax our own selves. Because, you know, dogs are, they're attached to us. We are part of their family and they are part of ours. So, you know, we have this, we take care of them, right? As you said, their well-being is really important to us. And unfortunately, though, if we start to worry about it, then that creates a sort of downward cycle. And so noticing, you know, times when things are going well and being able to create these situations like that, where the dog is doing well, is also really useful.
Definitely. I just want to stress that I know that some people recommend, oh, you just have to relax and then everything will be fine. Because if you're not relaxed, your dog is not relaxed. So I know that you were not saying that, but I know that some listeners might be asking themselves, oh, what if what if it's my fault and I just need to relax? So I just want to stress that just relaxing is not, it's not going to be
the
solution.
Right. It's like if you go out on a winter day, wearing a scarf is great. But if you know, it's not the only thing that's going to keep you warm. So you staying relaxed is wonderful. It's going to be it's going to help contribute to your dog's well-being. But you being stressed is not the cause of your dog's reactivity either.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you. We were talking about body language before too, looking at the dog's body language and kind of going from there and being able to tell what the next step is. So you just described a bat setup, which is, I think, a new word for a lot of people listening. So for you guys, again, it's called a bat setup because it's a special setup where you are very aware of how far you are away from the other dog and how okay your dog is with that. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. It's basically like a therapy session for your dog. Yeah. Rather than just, you know, going out on the street and figuring out how things go, you're arranging so you have a helper and you can coordinate, you know, and be able to have the dog specifically have a positive experience.
Yeah. I think there's quite a bit of effort that goes into that. If I think about it from my perspective, so if I wanted to start a bat setup, I would have to find a trainer. I would have to find a partner, another dog that is also kind of okay with that. I would have to find a location where to do that. Can you explain why it's still worth it to go through all that effort, and what the positive effects of that are? Because I know that they're great positive effects and I want more people to do it. So can you please tell us why?
So it's absolutely worth it. And here's the thing. So I lived with Peanut for probably 11 years with his reactivity. And we worked on counter conditioning and we did all these other things. And I had not done the bat setups for his reactivity with dogs. And then I did, I think it was something like 10 or maybe 12 bat setups with dogs. And then he was able to interact with other dogs on walks without having all of those big problems. So we can have a lifetime of having to worry about reactivity, or, you know, for 2 months, 6 months, some period of time, we can do these setups that do, yes, cost us time and effort. But in the long term, we're actually creating a healthier dog because their stress level is lower, their cortisol is lower, so they may live longer. Your walks are more pleasant. And just in general, you're caring for the well-being of your dog. You're not just saying, don't bark. You're saying, there's no reason to bark. And you're helping him discover that for himself so that the lesson will stick.
Yeah, but again, if somebody's listening and thinks, yeah, but I can just go out there and then maybe find the right distance to another dog, and then I can just click when they look at the other dog, and those are all great things, but what's the difference between actually diving into Tibet and really going for it compared to other techniques that we already try to use and maybe that you used before? And then, yeah, what's the difference if I really go for Tibet then?
So one is just this philosophical difference that you will find a very different way of being with your dog, or all dogs really. And I actually find it's beneficial even for myself in the way I interact with myself. But specifically relating to the reactivity, I found that dogs tend to be a little bit amnestic because they forget that you did all this training. When you take them out of the context of using the click and treat and all of that stuff, so that creates this sort of safety cue that the dog says, okay, I'm safe in this scenario when we're in working mode. But there's still a lot of reliance on one individual who's doing the training rather than it being about the dog. And so when I work with shelter dogs, or I work with families who have multiple people who are potentially going to be walking the dog, I want the dog to know that he's safe and that he can maneuver his own body to feel more comfortable, rather than it being like having to rely on the person to constantly click or pay attention, or, you know, saying, watch me, or any of those things. And yes, those are great tools to be using in between, so the dog does feel safe when you have to use that kind of management. But I definitely find that you're creating this much more confident, autonomous dog when we do Tibet. So it really gets to the root of the issue, which is that all of this behavior is about wanting to feel safe, or to be able to reduce arousal. It's very similar to, I'm going to circle back to that boring comment, that meditation is really boring, right? But it's amazing, and it creates an entirely different worldview. And so, yes, Tibet is boring, and it doesn't give you that like, woohoo, I'm doing something because I got to click and feed and be exciting. But it actually makes a really fundamental difference for the dog.
Yeah, it gives them a strategy to use, right? Because I feel like a lot of us, a lot of dog owners and dog trainers want to be active, and they want to feel like they're doing something, and they want to be active in the moment because you feel more like you're more in control of the situation. So,
which is ironic, because that's exactly the reason we want to do that for dogs, because that's what they need. They need to be in control of the situation.
Exactly. And control, I don't know if this is just in German or in English too, but control kind of has a negative connotation.
Right.
Especially when talking about dogs, because then the dogs are trying to control something. And
they're going to take over the house and get the keys to the car. And,
yes. Exactly.
Yeah. So don't worry about that. For those of you listening, it's so by control, I mean control over their own safety, their own sense of homeostasis, their balance, right? So, you know, if I'm sitting in a certain position and I'm uncomfortable and I move to be able to alleviate that discomfort, that's control, right? It doesn't mean that I have to tell the person across the room to do something. I'm just saying I want to control my own safety.
And I like thinking about it with looking at the opposite of control, because that would be loss of control. And then that also sounds much better. Yeah, you don't want your dog to feel like they're losing control, right? So I think that's great that Bat is giving them a strategy to actively do something. And we know what it feels like, that it feels great to have a strategy to deal with the situation. And, we want to give that to them. So
right.
I think that's amazing that, that Bat can do that.
And ultimately, if we think about control, by teaching our dog how to do this, we are still controlling the situation, right? We're still creating a situation in which our dog is safe. He can meet other dogs or not, depending on, you know, if the dog has killed other dogs, that may not be a final solution. We might want to, you know, learn to walk around them. But we are fixing the problem. It's just not right in that moment reaching in. So just like if you were the boss of an organization, right? I imagine a lot of you have had bosses where they told you, do this, do this, do this, like very micromanaging, versus a boss that says, I trust you, you can do this, here's this task, right? And so the boss is, yes, in control of you, and yet you're also in control of yourself. So the control is, it's not like a pie, you're not going to run out of it, right? You can both have control.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great comparison. And one of the things that the humans also stay in control is, I think, with that first step of finding a good distance. So I think that's a big question mm-hmm. that a lot of clients also ask, and that I also still find challenging to find out what is the right distance to start from. So if I just look at the everyday life, it's not always possible to find the right distance. But what recommendations do you have for the listeners to look at that and really figure out where their dog is at and what they're able to handle and how to find out what distance is okay?
Mm-hmm. So the distance will be different based on which aspect of Bat that you're using, right? So there's the kind of the standard version where the dog is learning the most that we tend to do in the setups. And so for that, finding the distance so there's no treats that you're not doling out treats for that, the distance is usually much larger than you would expect. And what you're doing is, or what I do is basically I kind of go as far as I can in the space that I have and then gradually let the dog go closer from there. But one way to also think about it is just that I'm looking for the dog to be interested in the environment and then able to also look at the other dog, you know, every at least probably minute or two and probably no more frequently than every 30 seconds. So if you're getting a constant amount of looking, then you're too close. But if the dog isn't looking at all, then you're either too far away or it's possible you're too close because some dogs will avoid when they start to get closer. So that's kind of a general rule of thumb is like every 1 to 2 minutes you want the dog looking up from sniffing to say, oh, is he still there? Yeah, not too close, not too far, no big deal. So that's one thing. And then if you're out on a regular walk, then you kind of have your experience from your walks as to how close you can be without your dog exploding. And a lot of times you may need to use what we call mark and move, which is what I had described with the greeting, where you click for looking at the other dog or maybe looking away from the other dog, move away and then give a treat. And in that case, you're going to be able to be a lot closer, which is one of the reasons I keep that in the protocol because, you know, it's real life. Dogs are going to go for walks sometimes. And so you need to have a tool. And so mark and move is that. So clicking as soon as like kind of for the biggest behavior toward disengagement that you think you can get. So usually that's a look and then a look away. But a lot of times it's just right as soon as they look, you click, you move away as far as you can, you know, like 3 or 4 meters, and then give a treat. And sometimes you can only move one step away before you treat, and that's fine too. You do whatever works.
That's interesting to look at that method as more of a management method. I think that's kind of how Bat changes the view on that method, because for other people or even for myself in the beginning, it was totally fine. I mean, just click for whenever they see the other dog, and that kind of gets you through a lot of situations easily, but it will also, as you described earlier, it'll also make you dependent on it. It'll make your dog dependent on it. And that will kind of be the only way it'll work. So if you want to get away from that, and if you want to give your dog the opportunity to use their own strategies to deal with that, then you might have to choose a longer distance. So I want to challenge our listeners at this point to really look at distance in a new way. So maybe try to think about when your dog is behaving in a way that really shows you that you're too close. So maybe on Instagram and Facebook, under the post that we will have for this episode, tell us at what distance your dog is still okay. I know that this is a very general way to phrase it, because there's huge there's huge differences, and sometimes it's hard to tell if your dog is still okay. And as you said, sometimes they will look away, sometimes they will stare for a long time. But I just want to challenge the listeners to think about it and maybe just put a number on it. Just say how many meters it is that you think your dog is still okay, because what that will do for you, I think, is that you will start going out on your next walks and then have that number in mind and kind of start to question that too and see, oh, maybe it's even closer, or maybe it's much further away that your dog is still okay and the distance that he needs. And I just think distance is such a powerful tool, as you said earlier too.
Yes, when in doubt, more distance is really the answer. And I think that, because we have been using counter conditioning with great success for a lot of dogs, I'm not saying it never works, but I think that whenever it does work, or honestly, whenever any technique works for dogs becoming more social with other dogs, is that when it works, that somehow a situation has been created that the dog feels safe enough to get some real interaction with the other dog. And that I believe is what changes their mind, not the actual part where we're giving a lot of treats. But I think it's when they actually learn, hey, dogs are interesting. I like them. They're safe, right? When they actually make friends, that's when it makes a difference. So the BAT process is really, it's about streamlining this idea of how can we make dog friends for our dogs. It's one way of thinking about it. Not that that's always the strategy, but that's a very important aspect of it, is that rather than just a bunch of acquaintances, that we're actually allowing dogs to make dog friends.
Yeah, and that's a goal for a lot of people, because they really want that for their dogs. And I think that that's great, but you just have to be aware of the fact that it might take a little time, that your dog might need a little more time than you would think.
Right. And that maybe they have, you know, five friends, and that they're not friends with the entire world yet. So I do find that there's some sort of magic number for each dog, that once they've made, you know, 10 or 15 friends, they're like, okay, I'm optimistic that the next dog might also be a friend. But at first, each time they make a new friend, it has to go through this very slow process.
Yeah, definitely. What I would be interested in is, you said that a lot of things have changed for your dogs. And are there still situations where you find it challenging, or where your dogs find it challenging to deal with certain situations? So I think it's, of course, BAT is not a wonder solution, a pill that you swallow
panacea,
and then everything.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's kind of more of an approach and a method to deal with the upcoming challenges. So how do challenges look like for you now? How do you deal with them?
So one thing that's still challenging for me with my dog Zuki, for example, and partially because I haven't done specific training with children as the trigger, but in my own house, when I have kids like running up and down the stairs, she starts to be like, okay, that's enough. And so she, you know, she gets excited and she starts barking, and part of it is fear. So not just excited and happy. And so there's management. And so I either will make the kids stop running around, or I will get her into another room with a toy or something else to do. Because part of my job is always going to be that sort of, I'm her protector. So I'm going to look to see, is this a situation where she's going to feel safe? And if so, I'm going to let her learn in it. Is she not going to feel safe? And if so, then I'll need to change something so she can feel safe.
Yeah, that's great. Well, when was the last time when you had that kind of situation?
Yesterday.
Oh.
So, I'm dating someone who has a kid now, apparently, I think. And and anyway, so yeah, he's like an elephant running up and down my stairs.
Yeah, I think that's very comforting for everybody to know that those situations will keep happening and that your dog is not magically cured, but you both just find strategies and ways to deal with those situations, right?
Right. Well, I'm a rock climber and I had shoulder surgery a couple of years ago. And I'm not going to say, well, the shoulder surgery was a complete failure because, you know, I can't do this one move anymore. It's like, no, I'm going to watch to see, is this safe for my shoulder? And if it isn't, then I won't do that thing. Right. As we're just going to find an entire lifestyle that is safe and then gradually push the envelope in terms of the dogs with training. Right. And so with my climbing, I don't really do bouldering as much anymore. I usually do with ropes so that if I ever need to just let go, I can. Right. Because that creates that safety. So that I'm never having to fully rely on my shoulder. So same with a dog. There may be a dog that has a big bite history. And so that dog maybe always wears a muzzle when he meets new dogs, for example, because it's just not a trustworthy situation. So you would, you know, you have to adjust to based on the individual dog of what's safe and what the dog can do. And not just safe for the other people, but safe in a sense of does the dog feel safe as well.
So I know that some of you listeners are thinking right now, well, my dog is just too aggressive because he's already shown a lot of aggression towards other dogs. He constantly barks and maybe he even bit a dog before. Or maybe you're thinking, my dog doesn't have that big of a problem, actually. He just sometimes barks and, you know, he wiggles around a little bit, but he'll be fine. So my question is, how do I find out whether Bat is actually suited for my dog and for me to use as a method and to really dive into from now on?
Well, Bat is really flexible. It works for dogs who are very reactive. So they've, you know, have a bite history, damaging other dogs or people or whatever else. Anywhere from that down to just socializing a puppy. So it's a very, to me, it's a really fundamental tool that I might use in concert with other things, depending on the situation, but it's pretty much always part of every treatment plan I have is how it is using those leash skills, giving the dog a sense of freedom whenever is possible. And then depending on the history of the dog, that situation where we create a sense of safety may look different for different dogs. We might be able to start right away with greeting, you know, greeting as if it's a puppy, or we might need to work on more distance first if it's a dog with a history. So it's a really flexible technique. And so I recommend that everybody look into it really. So not just for a specific issue. Just because I made it. I mean, I made it that way because I really love it. So yeah, I like things that have multiple uses.
Yeah, well, you already know that it's working for a lot of people too, because I know that a lot of people are huge fans, not just of you, but really also of the technique, and they're practicing it every day. And you can see that it works. I see it in our trainings at Dog It Right also, and you see that it works. So this is not just promoting a technique, but it's really just something that will help dog owners and their dogs kind of just have a better quality of life in their everyday life. So I think it's great. And I totally agree that everybody should look into it. And I have a bit of a challenging question for you. That's the last question. And I would like to know from you if there was one thing that you could tell the listeners, if there's one thing that you could tell all dog owners when it comes to dog greetings, what would that one thing be that you would really want everybody to know when it comes to this challenging topic?
I would say be aware of the emotional response of the of everyone involved, that there needs to be consent from, I guess consent is really the thing. So there needs to be consent from all of the humans, but there also needs to be consent from the dogs in the greeting. And I would say if you have a dog who's growling or barking, that one way to think of that, even though they might be rushing in, is that they are not giving consent for that greeting. So to be really mindful that both dogs especially are giving consent for the greeting.
That's great. That's awesome. Thank you so much. I think this talk was very, very helpful for all the listeners, and I hope that everybody enjoyed it. And I definitely want to thank you for taking the time and sharing all this with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Und wenn du jetzt mit deinem Hund BAT ausprobieren möchtest, entweder alleine oder zusammen mit einer Trainerin, dann schau doch mal bei Grishas Online-Kurs vorbei und den Link dazu findest du in den Shownotes. Und außerdem, hinterlass uns einen Kommentar bei Instagram und Facebook. Und zwar wollen wir wissen, wie weit muss dein Hund von anderen Hunden entfernt sein, damit es ihm noch gut geht? Also an welcher Stelle zeigt er noch keine Anzeichen von Stress? Sind es 10 Meter, 20 Meter oder 50 Meter? Sag's uns bei Instagram oder Facebook unter dem aktuellen Foto zu dieser Folge. Wenn du jetzt dein tägliches Dankbarkeitstagebuch führen möchtest, was wir vorhin erwähnt haben, um mehr Energie zu haben und auch mehr Geduld mit deinem Hund zu haben und auch den Stress, den man so im Alltag mit Hund manchmal hat, besser wegstecken zu können und dich auf die schönen Dinge im Leben mit deinem Hund zu fokussieren, dann findest du auch den Link zu unserem Dog Journal in den Shownotes. Wenn dir diese Folge gefallen hat, dann lass uns doch eine Bewertung bei iTunes da und folge unserem Podcast in deiner Podcast-App, damit du keine Folge mehr verpasst. Das war der Dog It Right Podcast, dein Podcast für entspannte Hundebegegnungen. Wir wollen, dass stressige Hundebegegnungen ab jetzt für euch Geschichte sind. Denn wir sind davon überzeugt, dass entspannte Spaziergänge die Voraussetzung für ein glückliches und gesundes Leben mit deinem Hund sind.